Please listen carefully.
What is communication?
The act of taking a thought from my head and putting it into your head.
Essential behavior of life. We have the both blessing and responsibility of trying to foster
it. It's the strongest way for two people to convey information to each
other. What I have in my head to the outside world.
I think it's the ability to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with
Whatever
others.
Whatever it is that we do to express intent and achieve an impact.
Communication is the ability to express your needs, wants, frustrations, and desires to anyone that you feel needs to have that information.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of the Speech Science Podcast. I'm Matt Hott and I am super excited, and it's not just because Big Brother has made it to the final seven and level six, which only has four members, is making it to the end. And if you don't watch Big Brother, you have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm excited because our level six is down to its four, and that's Michelle Wintering.
Hey.
Michael McLeod.
What's up, buddy?
And lost in the wilderness for months at a time, Lucas Stuber.
Hey, it is fantastic to be back. Thanks for having me.
Luke.
The wilderness. Is that where you were, Lucas?
I don't even know. I just sort of like got captured and thrown in a bag, and today here I am on this podcast. I've lost track.
So we do our roundabouts, and I want to start off. I really want to know, Luke, where have you been?
You are a personal owned farm in
San Diego.
In the world is
Lucas Stuber.
Game from time to time, I think. Well, it's been a little wacky. So those of you that have been on this pod for a long time or listened to the Talking with Tech pod, just about exactly 2 months ago, I took a job running the software side of Tobii Dynavox, right? So the language systems, the augmentative communication side, not the fancy hardware stuff. I'm nowhere near smart enough to do the eye tracking and all that, but the language systems. And boy, oh boy, I knew that was going to be a life change, but it has been quite a bit. So just about immediately, we announced the acquisition of Smartbox out in the UK, which really is good news, I swear. And I'm not coming to be Mr. Tobii. I see. Look, he mutes me right when I'm saying this.
I meant to mute myself so I could cough, and I muted you by accident.
But so anyway, so it's been a little while. So over the last few weeks, have been out in Sweden, in the UK, and a couple places in the US, and I'm home tonight, and I think I'll be leaving again in like a week, but for the moment, I'm stationary and therefore on the pod.
How was the hot chocolate in Sweden?
You know, I actually didn't try the hot chocolate, and I have been scolded by multiple people.
That's Switzerland. I'm Swiss Miss is what I was thinking of.
I was wondering there for a moment. In Sweden, it's mostly fish and fish.
I really want some Swedish listeners to like write in about the hot chocolate conversation.
Yeah, Matt.
You know Matt about that?
Oh man, you can totally email us. Our email is speechscience2018@gmail.com. Michelle Wintering, how is life with Baby Speech Science?
Baby Speech Science is doing well. We're actually, I mentioned this to Matt before we went on the air, but remember that article from a few weeks ago that we were discussing on posterior tongue ties and some of the research? Well, it turns out I'm taking my son to get his posterior tongue tie released tomorrow. So we'll see if I have any other feedback on that for you.
Wow. Let's just talk about happy stuff.
Yeah. Hopefully it's a happy thing, but he smiles and laughs now.
Aww.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. Wait until the 4 a.m. midnight to 4 a.m. feedings end, and then it'll be really nice.
Well, thankfully he's a pretty good sleeper. He sleeps a couple longer chunks at night. But there will come a day in my life when I'll know what 7 or 8 hours of sleep is like again.
No, I haven't ever gotten back to that point, by the way. What is it? I'm the AAC guy talking up, right? What's a posterior as opposed to a superior tongue tie?
Anterior or posterior.
So anterior, are we talking below the tongue or behind the...
They're both below the tongue, but anterior is just the more obvious one, the one that pediatricians and doctors will catch right at birth and often clip or release because it makes that heart shape and it pulls the tongue down well as back. But posterior tongue tie is more, can be submucosal. So it can be at the base of the tongue and keep the tongue from lifting so it can't move up.
So I couldn't remember which of the two was
yeah. Yeah. And then they often co-occur, my understanding, with the lip ties a lot of times in the buccal cavities.
So. For those of you at home, I am currently testing my tongue in all directions.
All different directions.
Michael McLeod, how is life out in Philadelphia? I was trying to think of the Boys to Men song and I couldn't think of the lyric in time.
You just hesitated because you forgot. You forgot where.
No, I East Coast Philly back again. All right, there we go. I was trying to.
All right, Matt. I had no idea what state I was in anywhere west of the Mississippi.
Texas, Arkansas, Arizona.
Arkansas is not even west of the Mississippi. Oh.
I know. That's the thing. It said.
Oh no, it's not.
Episode 47, Matt. 47.
Oh, Michael McLeod. How are things? How are you, buddy?
Things are going great. The school year is off in full swing very quickly. Right, it's only been about a week or two, but things are moving very fast. Got my research study starting on Wednesday at my school, so that's going to be a real busy thing this school year. I just had a new nephew born 2 weeks ago.
Oh, congrats!
Yep. So that's real exciting. And
how does he have?
None that I know of, but you never know. I feel like after this episode, I could diagnose him myself. So
there you go. Well, you are a speech and language pathologist.
That's true.
You know, that is like one of the worst things, I think, not worst things, but one of the difficult things about having a kid and being trained in this field is knowing how development works and knowing what can go wrong or what might go wrong or any of the above. And it is terrifying.
Absolutely. I've thought about that a million times, just in terms of even like before the baby's born and after the baby's born. It's just, I don't even have any kids. And I think about this with my peers, friends, and my family's kids. It's a nerve-wracking thing.
My youngest choked on a chip the other day, almost 2-year-old. And by choked, I mean, he kind of coughed, gagged a little bit. And in my brain, I went, what level of penetration is this? Do I need to get him to the ER? Should I flip him over now? Should I wait to see if he can? He's walking away and giggling. Okay, I guess that's over. Okay. But in my brain, like in that first 2 seconds, it felt like 5 minutes of like triage time.
The opposite can be kind of true though too. Like working exclusively in AAC, sometimes I was hanging out with some friends that have a 2.5-year-old, and their son strung like 6 words together in front of me, and I was like, "Well, hello, Einstein."
That is true. You do have to get a reset sometimes of
like what are these norms again?
Yeah, what is typical norms?
So for me, my week last week started off really well with me hanging out in the emergency room for 3 hours.
Matt, why do you always have emergency room stories?
What's going on, man? Come pad your house.
So I got bit by somebody and it took about an hour to clean the wound and get me my antibiotics. And then I had to wait 2 hours for the drug and alcohol people to show up so I could get tested since I got hurt at work.
Okay, so you got bit at work.
I did. I got bit by...
Adult or child?
Child.
Okay.
So your supervisor.
Yeah, by my supervisor. She got mad at me for not writing a SMART goal for my personal development and lashed out.
I was going to say, maybe it was a grad student you were supervising. Yeah,
I didn't know if it was home health or if it was...
Oh, no. So basically, we were working on something and he almost got me a couple of times, or the student almost got me a couple of times. And the third time I didn't move quick enough and just ripped off a piece of skin and it started bleeding. And my initial reaction went, oh, I guess I'm bleeding now. And the physical therapist like looked at me and was like, I think you might be in shock. And I was like, I should probably end my therapy session now. So I walked the kid back to the room. Went down to the ER,
blood.
I had my arm up, I had it above my heart, and I walked down to the ER, or not the ER, the nurse, and she just looked at me and was like, did you clean this yet? And I went, no, it just happened like moments ago. And then I went to the ER. So.
Wow. So that, I mean, that sounds like a pretty substantial bite then. Can I jump in and just endorse the concept of Kevlar sleeves that have saved me?
I am ordering them now. I'm showing it on the video. This is,
oh yeah. Okay.
That's a week.
That's a legit bite, man.
That's a week later too. So.
All right.
You might become a superhero.
Radioactive spider bites. I did get the new on a positive because of last week. I went out and bought myself the new Spider-Man video game. And
is it as fun as it's supposed to be? Because I'm thinking about it.
So, Michael, you and I have talked about the video game screen time before. And my son, the 5-year-old, and I, over the weekend, I think we spent a combined 16 to 18 hours between Friday and Sunday night in front of the TV playing this damn thing.
Nice. Impressive.
So, screen time. And then afterwards, my wife goes, aren't you the one that says you don't like screen time? And I'm like, well, screen time in moderation. And we were giggling and laughing about Spider-Man's opponents. Yeah. So
what rating?
Screen time, and then there's Spider-Man. Okay.
There was social interaction going on.
What rating does the game get on the hotometer?
On the hotometer, I would say 4 out of 5. It's actually a really fun game. So I like it.
Not bad.
You only go to 5 on games?
Yeah, because I don't have a whole guys, I don't have a system yet, so please don't make fun.
Okay, all right.
So what game would you consider a 5 in the history of games?
Or is there one?
I think the Metal Gear Solid Phantom Pain one is pretty good.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
So, nerdiness, I'm a big third-person game typer, so I don't like the first-person shooters like Call of Duty. I like the third person one where you see the figure in front of you, because I'm a terrible first person shooting game guy.
Thank you for clarifying what you meant by that, because yes. I did not know.
First person, just like in a book where the narrator says, I did this. Third person, like in a book, he says he or she did that. Those are the games I play.
That way, when you lose, you can like blame the protagonist, not yourself.
Yeah, I think Fortnite is considered a third player game, right?
Yes, it is.
Fortnite would indeed be a third person. Yeah.
So we have a voicemail this week before we get too far.
Woo!
And let's see, share computer sound.
It's from the person
who's sharing. And here we go.
Hi from New Zealand. My name's Brooke. I'm a speech language therapist down here. I work with adults and kids. And I just wanted to send this message to tell you that I really enjoy your podcast. Thank you for taking the time to chat through so many different topics relevant to our profession. And I really like the way that you guys present it in such a casual yet informative way. I actually wanted to ask you guys whether or not you'd be willing to have a chat on your podcast about ABA. I've definitely been trained to be a little more pro floor time strategies and mindset when it comes to working with students with autism. But I also would be the first to admit that I'm also quite ignorant when it comes to ABA. So I really would just love to hear you guys chat through ABA versus floor time. You've mentioned floor time before, and just have a chat around the differences and kind of just inform us all a little bit more as speech therapists around the research, but also what your opinions are. So yeah, I'd just wanted to come in and ask you that and just say you're doing a great job. Thank you. And hi from New Zealand. Okay, bye.
Oh, that was Brooke from New Zealand. And can I say that I love like the Australian New Zealand accent? Like, I don't know why, but like every time I do, I want to hang out with that person even more. Chris Hemsworth, Brooke, we had one a year ago.
Yep.
Who was the crocodile hunter? Paul Hogan or something like that?
Something like that.
But no, like the Hemsworth brothers, when they talk, I'm like Thor. I'm like, yeah. But no, ABA floor time. I don't know a whole lot about ABA, like in and outs. I know it's very controversial with speech because there's the encroachment or the possible encroachment of scope of practice. But I work with a pretty awesome ABA behavioral therapist. And we actually have a pretty decent working relationship together.
Lucky you.
I've worked the BCBAs that I've worked with. It's been in the camp setting that I've talked to you guys about before. So it's been in a very team oriented, short term kind of setting. So they're not going through the full ABA process with these campers that we're working with. So my experience has been very positive. And if anything, I've picked up different strategies that I can support them with, and they can support my goals with.
This whole ABA DIR thing, how it's just two different ends of the spectrum, like black and white, right and left. It's really amazing how it's grown into this whole one side of the field or the other. Like you're either this side or you're that side. It's really amazing how they've just become such polar opposites in this field.
What's caused that?
I guess it's really the different professions. You're most likely going to find more SLPs that are more on the DIR play side, and then you're going to have the ABA, and like you spoke about before, the whole encroachment on the field thing. I think that just really comes from people that just have that intensive background in ABA and
funding. I mean, funding is a big piece of it, right?
Yes.
You know, some pretty powerful arguments that were made in, you know, really starting in California, but in a variety of other places over the past 10 years, where ABA practitioners have argued very effectively that the idea of like discrete trial training, right, or like these really context-independent interventions, they're very easy to collect data around, right? Like you can say like, okay, we went from 0 out of 10, you know, instances at this level of prompting for this child to be selecting this item, you know, given X language input, and, you know, up to 10 out of 10, because that's such an easy thing to sort of, to prove and to train. Whereas the DIR or four time or even just typical speech path approach to things is, I don't want to say more fluffy, but more holistic, more context-based, more, you know, grounded in this idea of naturalistic use and generalization of other contexts. And even me saying these things, you probably can interpret my bias to some extent, right? Mm-hmm. That in the AAC world, for example, or even where I came from, you know, out on the West Coast, like ABA is pervasive. Like it's huge. And I have known a number of BCBAs that are totally fantastic, but I will say that viewing language as purely a response to stimulus, I think, undervalues some of the beauty and generability and humanity of what we do with communication, right? And so that's just sort of where I'm coming from with that, but I think it warrants a much longer conversation.
I would love to have a longer talk if we can find some articles on it. And I hadn't thought of what you just said, Lucas, of it's almost like a qualitative versus quantitative.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Debate, like that polarizing sort of piece, which you get in PhD research programs too, of what's a more valid thesis and what's a more valid dissertation. Is it qualitative or quantitative?
So. See, I guess my approach to language in general, maybe, Luke, you may not like me after I say this, but sometimes I really do feel like language is just that response to a stimulus. And I say that with like that face on my, or that look on my face, because like, I don't know. I part of me sometimes wonders like about that. And, you know, is it more, you know, is it, I guess I look at it as when we say the word milk, it has no meaning to it until someone tells us that the word milk means a cool, refreshing treat.
Right. Well, and just in the same sense that there's the time and a place to learn how to tie your shoes. Right.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
The environment. But that doesn't. Right. So there's a difference between what do you want? Milk or cookies? Or like, do you want to initiate interaction? Do you want to stop interaction? Do you want to like refuse something? And then there's, you know, to be or not to be, that is the question. Blah, blah, blah. You know, like more complex language use.
Okay, that's fair.
And again, I'm not, I really don't intend to take any sort of position here, but I think that it warrants a much longer conversation
because I've seen
on both, on all sides of this that are, you know, have good arguments.
Quick question. What does DIR stand for again?
Developmental. Individual relationship.
Individual difference relationship based model.
DIR. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Stanley Greenspan.
I always just hear the floor time.
Nah, we'll leave it in. Yeah, but you know what, Brooke? Thanks for giving us a ring. And if you have an idea that you want to tell us about, head over to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. From there, you can email us, speechscience2018@gmail.com. Or give us a phone call on our brand new Columbus phone number, 614-681-1798. Luke, since you moved down to Portland, we changed area codes and phone numbers and all that. Coming up around Hey, the Buckeyes won. Anyway, coming up around the bend, we're going to talk about spousal perspectives when having a spouse with aphasia, dementia in the wintertime, and we're going to lead off with monolingual or bilingual, which is better for your student or child with autism. You're listening to Speech Science.
Some knowledge belongs to us and us alone. The way our girlfriends walk, the way they talk, the way they touch their hair. We hold details that only a sister can know about her girls. But what about our other girls? The ones that we carry with us every day. Can we describe them when everything's right? Can we feel when something's wrong? Our bond with our sister girls gives life. But knowing your breasts can save it. You don't know why. Go to knowyourgirls.org for the facts you need on breast health. That's knowyourgirls.org, brought to you by Susan G. Komen and the Ad Council.
Okay, men, this is your time. Maybe you didn't choose this, but you're here now. You're gonna go out there and be an all-star caregiver. It's up to you. So what are you gonna do? You're gonna go grocery shopping, cook, clean, be there emotionally and physically. You gotta dig deeper. Drive them to physical therapy, doctor's appointments. Don't you forget about the pharmacy. I know you won't, because that's what caregivers do. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. This is your time to show the world, your family, and yourself that you're tougher than tough. Now go out there and be the best caregiver this world has ever seen. Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Speech Science, episode 47. I'm Matt Hott, joined, I don't even know how to do this anymore, from Easter to West, it would be Luke Stuber, Stoiber.
Am I East?
Yeah, you're, no. Michael McLeod's the farthest East.
Yeah.
Matt, we're going to get you a map of the United States.
Yeah. Start over.
Start small.
We need I don't even know. The farthest East is Michael McLeod. The next farthest East is Lucas Stoiber. Then there is myself and Cincy, and then Michelle Wintering.
I'm straight south of you.
Yeah, so I guess we're technically even.
Where are you, Michelle?
Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay, all right.
She is in charge of all of the gold in the entire U.S. Reserve.
So none of it, then?
All I know about Fort Knox is they have a softball field right outside of the fort because my sister played in a softball tournament, and we had to drive way out of town so my dad could go buy beer at a bar for all the softball dads.
I'm sure there are a lot of softball fields here, Matt.
No, it was like
about Fort Knox.
No, we were like within, no, like legit, we were, oh, sorry, Luke, what were you saying?
I was making a James Bond joke. Oh.
No, like the softball fields, we could watch the military trucks drive onto base.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
So like that close. And about Pittsburgh, I will say that coming out of the Liberty Tunnel might be the coolest view I've ever seen coming into a city.
It is a pretty neat little reveal there, I admit. If you can make it through the tunnel.
Yeah, if you don't die in the tunnel. Are you guys familiar with that?
I'm not. I've never heard of that.
No. Are you guys familiar with the Virginia Beach Bay tunnel where you go under the water?
Nope.
Wow. Well, anyway, so imagine driving through a mountain and you see nothing. And traffic is probably going to murder you. And then at the very end, boom, there's Pittsburgh. And it's Pittsburgh on the river, and you got Three River Stadium, and or not even Three River Stadium anymore, PNC Park and Heinz Field and the rivers. It's really cool.
That feels like you just made it to, like, you know, Emerald City or something. Yeah. Except for no emeralds.
It's like the Land Before Time where they just come out and
yeah, that's it. The only thing cooler I've ever seen is when you drive under the Chesapeake Bay and come up near Virginia Beach. So anywho, evidently I'm the only one that drives into tunnels and gets amazed by
No, I mean,
We haven't died in a mountain yet, so.
I just always get quiet when I hear the Land Before Time movie. Because
have you all seen the videos of babies driving through tunnels?
Yes.
I'm going to send you all a video. I'll have to share it with the group about my son, his first car ride home, because he looks like a baby in the tunnels.
I love how they'd be like, going by, like,
well, this podcast has officially gone off the rails. It's only taken us one segment.
It always does.
If you have anything you want us to tell us about, head to our website, podcast.speechscience.org. And from there, you can email us, speechscience2018@gmail.com, or give us a phone call, 614-681-1798. Also, hit us up on the Twitters, hashtag speechscience. So let's start off when we talk a little bit about the monolingual or the bilingual experience with students with autism or our students in general. There's always a debate about, does exposing my student or my child to multiple languages, will that slow down his language development? And then when you add something in such as autism, the bigger question is, will I mess up my kid, in air quotes, if I try to make them bilingual?
Is this really still a question?
Oh, for sure, dude. You know, I work in a school, and that is a question we get from parents all the time.
I have also gotten this question a ton of times, and I'm always amazed at it. This is just one of those small little pieces of information that us SLPs just take for granted, that outside people just really don't have a grasp on like we do. And it's important for us to spread this info.
Yeah, so I've been asked that as well.
If you learn how to use chopsticks, do you forget how to use a fork?
I mean, I appreciate your analogy.
You know, as you put that into that perspective, it makes the whole conversation seem moot. But ScienceDirect.com will have the article up there from researchers Dye, Burke, Nagels, Igesti, and Fine looked at this in detail of a study of 388 children, and they came out that showed greater language impairment in ASD than developmental delay, but no main effect for language exposure group nor any interaction of language group by diagnosis.
Right. So you get a different degree of language delay with diagnosis, but not due to L2 exposure.
Exactly.
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, what's the interesting thing about this is that we have found over and over again that not only is it not detrimental, but it's actually beneficial to have simultaneous L1 and L2 acquisition, to the point that I think we might have even talked about this on like episode 20 or something of Speech Science, which I still find this fascinating, that if you have simultaneous bilinguals, like somebody who grows up speaking English and Spanish, that they have different intraoral posture for the starting position when speaking each language. So like your tongue and your lips and your teeth will actually start in a different place between the two, which is why you will maybe not have a differential or a difference in accent, right, or identifiably between English and Spanish. Whereas if you have somebody who maybe acquires Spanish later, they're still going to be speaking Spanish with the English intraoral posture. Which is why you have an accent, right?
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So even from like a motor memory standpoint, it is beneficial to have the L2 acquisition as early as possible.
Is that why I can't roll my R's in German or Spanish?
Very possibly.
I mean, like, legit, is that why?
We don't have, like, I mean, actually, what's interesting is the rhotic R, like, R, the retroflex R that we have in English is the weird one. Like, in any other language in the world, they have other R's that are actually much easier. Like I can't do the, like, Qatar is a really good example. Like, that, like, really do, like, Qatar, I can't do it.
But what word are you even saying?
Qatar, like the country Qatar.
Qatar?
Yeah,
Qatar or Qatar is what people say.
Qatar, yeah.
But really, it's Qatar. And I can't, it's hard to do. It's almost like a glottal R. But that is so much more pervasive in Middle Eastern and Indian languages. Like, or then you have the trill, right? Which, I mean, for me, it's almost comical. Like, I want to be like, perro, like, perro, perro. That's it. That's all I can do.
Somewhere someone listening to this podcast is screaming out in pain.
Yeah, for
how we're pronouncing
things. Or has swerved in the oncoming traffic. We've made them push it too far. But I remember from language development class back at Kent State that what do they say? Like, when we're born with all of the abilities to produce every sound in the human ability, or articulation, or phonetic inventory. But as we, our brain myelinates, it just loses that ability.
Yeah.
But I think what we don't use, we don't use. So we don't learn the motor memory, the sequencing, all that other stuff for it.
Right.
So it becomes a lot harder to try to learn that later versus incidental learning as you're learning language, birth to three.
Right. Well, so another piece that I guess just in support of the, learning other languages isn't a bad thing is the evidence that we have from traumatic brain injury and other similar things where people will have a CVI, right? A cerebrovascular incident of some kind, whether that's secondary to an injury or a stroke, and suddenly lose their ability to speak in L1, but retain it in L2. And they sort of found that there were different parts of the brain storing this knowledge in of these different languages, which again just goes to show that there is, I'm not trying to speak to that at a high level. Like, I really don't know the details of that, but clearly there's capacity in the brain for this second language in some other spot.
We would get the question a lot when I worked at the school for the deaf and the blind about sign language and a verbal spoken language. And thank you, Lucas, for signing random words to me.
And, I've got more please and thank you. That's it.
Perfect.
And snack. Snack.
I think you said but so.
That's a big misconception, just like the L1, L2. That a visual spatial language, why are you signing curse words?
I just learned the sign for BS and I love it so much.
Well, that's not what most people use. That's okay, the literal word versus
full.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways,
for those of you at home that don't realize that this is a podcast,
right? Like Lucas, now. Anyways, but people get very caught up on it being a visual spatial language versus a verbal language, and they are concerned that a visual spatial language, even for a deaf child, is going to impact their ability to learn a verbal language. And all the research, again, just like the L1, L2 with verbal languages, is showing that it actually is really beneficial. It's not going to harm their verbal language. So.
And part of me wonders, and Michael, maybe you can touch on this because you're the executive functioning guru of the group. I would think that multiple languages would make it easier for the child to communicate. Similar, like how we pair signs or signs with words when we're working with, yeah. Am I far off on the executive functioning there, or is that way outside your scope of understanding or practice? Or,
well, yeah, it overall matters in terms of, you said it doesn't make it easier for them to communicate. It just depends on the situation, the environment, and exactly what's happening in terms of organizational skills, self-regulation skills, working memory. How are they able to look in and obtain all of that information from the varying languages to use it appropriately in a natural environment? So there's many different things at play there in terms of being able to use the different languages correctly in different situations. But yeah, that's just like we spoke about before, when we get these questions from parents, so far all the research is just pointing to overwhelmingly positive effects of the bilingual brain. And we've talked about before on this podcast of those positive effects reaching across the entire lifespan of having healthier brains when you're an adult and when you're a geriatric.
That makes sense. I'm always glad that I bring smarter people than myself onto the podcast because I learn something every week.
Matt, stop being too self-deprecating.
Yeah, man. We all get bit sometimes.
Hey, you know what? If you've learned something, head to our website, podcast.speedscience.org. Michael, I want you to say that three times fast.
I can't.
Okay. You can email us speedscience2018@gmail.com or give us a phone call 614-681-1798.
Podcast.speechscience.org. Podcast.
Oh, my
God. Putica. Oh, yeah. Diodacokinesis.com.
Anywho's. One of the biggest struggles I have as a home care therapist, and it's not a struggle, but conversations I have is how to deal with the family of a patient. And did you guys see the new Journal of Speech, Language, and Hearing Research? They talk about the spousal perspective. And one of the hardest things that I always have the conversation with families is that they just don't know what to do. They feel guilty when they leave their spouse at home. They get upset with their spouse because they don't remember or they can't think of the word. There's sometimes spouses that or family that think the patient is faking. Have you guys run into any of that, like with the youth side or any of your adult side, before we get too far into this article?
In terms of the spouse doing what?
Well, like in the family, like, so for example, when I work with my families, part of my home care is working the family through it's okay to have those negative emotions or how to handle yourself and then how not to be the therapist, but just to be the spouse. Or am I the only one that does that? And maybe I'm a crazy person.
I think any of us can relate to that just with family members of young kids too, all the way up. And you work more with adults than a lot of us here. I've worked limited PRN with home health care. But you're in people's homes. So of course you're going to need to address the people in that home are part of the environment.
Because I mean, I think we spend so much time working with our patients that we can sometimes miss the family support. I mean, we, of course, when you have a child come into the clinic and they're 3 years old, you're going to work with the family to build a language rich environment. But there's not a whole lot. I don't see a whole lot of us working with families on, you know what, if you want to take, and I know Luke, you're probably biting your tongue because I've seen the pictures you put on Facebook with some of the stuff, but like, it's hard. How do you explain to a parent that it's okay to take your other kids to the park if you want to show them extended one-on-one time because they don't get it during the week? Or when I'm working with a patient's wife or husband and they ask me, is it wrong that I just want to go shopping by myself and call in somebody to sit with my husband or wife for a few hours for me to have some alone time?
That's respite care. I mean, respite care is a thing and exists and has for a long time. I think we need to encourage families to do that. That just like any relationship, if you're going to be the best caretaker for this person, they have to take care of themselves.
Yep. And I think a lot of people have to get over the guilt initially about taking advantage of those services, right?
Definitely.
It's interesting because in pediatrics, like you alluded to, like we, you know, I spend a lot of time helping families to become part of the circle of support, right? Which can be interpreted as becoming, you know, clinicians in their own way. But it is a fair point to bring up that that's not their role, right? And that shouldn't be what they're expected to be. You can't flip that on 24 hours a day. I just had a conversation with an SLP, Betsy Furler, who she's pretty active and out there if you're in, you know, the Facebook world. And one point that she made, and maybe we can open this up to debate because I've been thinking about it ever since she said it, is that if the family is not ready to start intervention, that they shouldn't start intervention. Does that make sense? Like that if you're not ready to sort of assume all of the support obligations that are entailed, then maybe you should give it a little time until you're ready. And I'm really on the fence about how I feel about that.
Yeah, that's very situation dependent. There's services that can be provided for specific disorders or disabilities that the family does not need to be directly involved in. And, you know, there's sometimes starting intervention can be that spark that's needed. You could not be ready, but starting it and getting the flow of it is what's going to cause the positive progress. So I'm also on the fence about that.
And in some ways, how are you ever ready for that? Exactly.
I don't mean to like, Betsy, if you're listening, I'm sorry, I don't mean to like throw you. The context of her comment was more along like a couch to 5K sort of argument. Like, you know,
okay.
You might be ready for that 100-meter dash, but you're not ready for the marathon yet, you know? And you shouldn't like trick yourself into thinking you are. I mean, that said, I agree. It's like, you know, you don't know until you try, right? You know?
Is this an AAC person?
This is an AAC person. Yeah.
Okay. Well, some of the intensive AAC therapy, I can see where that will certainly apply.
I don't know. I just broke something. I don't disagree with that thought process at all, though. Like, I don't know how many times I work with in the home care side or with, I'm trying to fix something over here if you hear that clicking sound. I don't know how many times I've worked with somebody on the home care side or somebody at the high school where the family's not ready to buy in and the patient's not ready to buy in, and you spin your wheels for a few months trying to get them on to go. And then all of a sudden when they're ready to go, there goes the funding window, and you've spent 6 of your 8 weeks trying to get them to buy in, and then they finally buy in, and then, nope, now funding's over because your cert period's over.
Well, sometimes half the battle in life is just showing up.
So true.
Showing up to therapy, whether it be bringing your kid to therapy or signing on to therapy or whatever it may be, just showing up, whether you buy in or not, is half the battle. And sometimes it's on us to make sure that progress is being tracked and it's being shown, and you're able to really show that this is a positive thing and this is bringing about positive change, and we can be the change. We can bring about that buy-in.
Yeah. Well, and there was an interesting conversation in one of the email chains that I'm on for work. And they asked about why for a company wide, why the increase in missed visits. And part of it is the lack of buy-in. So maybe I'm just looking at it from that conversation where, you know, you get a patient who just left the hospital and you get a patient that just left the hospital and they just want to go to Kmart. They want to go to Buffalo Wild Wings. They want to go see their grandchildren. They want to do X, Y, or Z, and they're not ready for therapies to start.
So your examples are killing me. Sometimes they just want to go to Buffalo Wild Wings.
B-dubs, go watch some football. Matt, please add yours.
So a little behind the scenes thing, I am home alone tonight with my two boys, and my wife is working an overnight shift because she is a superwoman. And I give out all shout outs to anybody that's a mom, because as a dad, we get to do all the fun stuff and moms have to do the hard stuff. So my wife is out actually working overnight. So my 5-year-old is patiently waiting way past his bedtime to hang out with me. So aww. I apologize if you hear him in the background.
Those Christmas pajamas are sweet.
Right, because they fit. And
you know what? I fully support awesome. Wearing Christmas pajamas year round.
That's right.
For anyone.
It was cold today. It was not warm.
It was 60 degrees. I'm loving it here in Ohio. I saw the funniest thing.
I loved it here too.
They said they were like, yesterday it was 95 degrees and then the hurricane hit and now winter has come.
I love that. I got to say, one of the weirdest things about coming out to the East Coast from the West is like in Pittsburgh, it's been raining like just ludicrous amounts of rain, like all of the rain in the world, like to the point where it's like, where are the fish? Like the fish need to be okay. There needs to be water left for them. And
Lucas, you're not on the East Coast.
Wherever the heck I am.
East Coast time zone.
I'm in the East time thing. But like on the West Coast, if it rains a lot, it's like the people will say, like, oh, well, it's the coastal waters and the gorge or whatever. But out here, they're like, yeah, that's the tail end of a hurricane. And I'm like, really? Like there's like the hurricane gets up here. Like,
yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Midwest.
So do I get to claim now that I was in a hurricane? Can I use that?
No, because it's no longer the hurricane force winds.
East side.
I saw a tornado once, which by saying that, what I mean to say is that I saw a dust devil from a distance. And that's my only sort of environmental claim to fame. So,
wow.
One time I had really loud upstairs neighbors.
Oh my gosh. All right, moving on. Okay. Podcast.speechscience.org, email speechscience2018@gmail.com, or our phone number 614-681-1798. An interesting article out of Medical News Today. This was published back on Friday the 7th. Dementia symptoms can be worse in the wintertime. I feel like maybe because I work in home healthcare and I see a lot of patients all year round, I see an increase in patient referrals from about end of November till spring, probably right around Easter.
Maybe.
Shaking your head, no, Mike.
Am I just being I saw this and I immediately thought, I thought this was kind of known already. Is that for most people, that's why there's higher incidences of seasonal depression in places that don't have, like Alaska, that have long periods of dark. I thought that was more common knowledge.
Yeah, like the northernmost high school in America, which is in Alaska, also has the highest incidence of teen pregnancy and alcoholism, which to me just means winter is boring. And like in the absence of stimulus, dementia becomes more apparent, I guess.
Well, and then let's make sure that we're also talking, when we identify dementia, dementia is just that overall term for memory loss. We're not talking specifically Alzheimer's or cardiovascular or Lewy body. We're just talking about memory loss.
Good point clarifying that, Matt. Thank you.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that I try to, when I work with my patients, I try to not normalize the word dementia, but get them to understand that the diagnosis of dementia is not the end of the world, that it's not the notebook level of dementia, that, and not necessarily the notebook level of dementia, where she had to have her life story reread to her. It's just that idea of memory loss.
Right. And of course, all the concomitant
anxiety right.
and everything else. But right, it could be primary progressive. It could be secondary to a million other things. So I wonder if it's just like that's the period at which it's identified, or is that the period also at which potentially people need secondary caregivers, right? Is there another thing about winter that makes it more of a burden logistically?
It says the colder months, the participants were 31% more likely. They use the term likelier to fall into the range of diagnosis. And you know what though? Like I tell my patients that a lot of times it could be what I call like the retiree-itis, where if you go by the mini mental or the slumps and you go by it by the book and you ask them what the date is, and today is September 10th when we're recording it, and they say, I think it's September 9th. Technically, that's the wrong answer. And that one point can slip them into a diagnosis of dementia, when in reality, if it's the middle of wintertime and they haven't left their home in 4 days because there's six to eight inches of snow on the ground, and the fact that they know the date within 2 to 3 days, I don't know.
Come on.
No, but like if you're given a standardized assessment, you got to be right on track. But
yeah, I feel like that's interesting because, I mean, this is a lot of these standards. But do you think people were more likely to know the date in the 70s, for example, than we are now when we're more reliant on? Like a good example I have of this is, I don't know if you guys have administered the Boston test of aphasia, right?
Yeah.
But have, you know, all these sort of like short stories that you tell at one point during this assessment just to check on like sort of situation understanding. And one of them was about like, why does everybody at the Army base hate the bugler? Does anybody know?
Is it because he wakes you up?
I live on an army base, so.
Because he wakes you up, right? Yeah, because he's the guy that plays Reverie in the morning and he's like your alarm clock. But I was giving this to a gentleman who had aphasia, who was in his 80s, and he looked at it and he goes, what the F is a bugler? And it was like, oh, right, because you have no military background knowledge or whatever. When this was written in the height of Vietnam War, like, chances are everybody had that knowledge, right? I don't know. I guess I'm just curious. I mean, this is a much broader discussion, but to what extent?
Well, no, and it's an interesting thing because I'm thinking of, I just gave the slums and the mini mental today. And the first 10 questions are all stuff that if a patient is off by a hair, it could drop you from being within the normal range to dementia. The first 5 questions of the mini mental is, what is today's date? What is the month? What day of the week it is?
Is the mini mental, is that a screener or is that
actual? Yeah. They're both screeners. They're both assessments.
It's like a Maxi Mocha.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of times when you go into home care, you know, you're given so much that you can, you know, carry.
I understand that. I use screeners a lot. Yeah. But I was
and the mini mental and the slums are free. So I think.
You know, is that a tool we should be using to say we need to test further versus saying you have dementia?
Yeah, I use the RIPA too later on for some of my patients if they've stayed on for more than a certain period. But over the weekend, I was testing a patient and I said, okay, I'm going to give you 5 objects to memorize. And she looks at me and goes, "Are they apple, penny, and a table?" And I went, and house and car? And she's like, I've had your test already 4 times in the last 3 weeks. And I went,
wow.
Well, you're going to pass this one. And I'm unsure. You probably don't have dementia since you remember taking it 3 times. But
at least with the mocha, there's like 3 versions.
Is there really?
Yeah, there's 3 English versions and there's like 50 in other languages.
And that's the hard part with home health care, too, because I remember when I was doing home health care in El Paso that you would have these patients for a week and sometimes and that's it.
So. Yeah, for some reason right now, I'm in the midst of having patients for 2 to 3 cert periods. Okay. So we're looking at 4 to 6 months of therapy.
That's great, though.
So yeah, I get to see a lot of growth, but unfortunately, I can only test them so many times, and every 30 days you need an assessment. So,
yeah, that's tough.
Well, we want to hear from you. Head over to our website, I just bit my lip, podcast.speechscience.org. And from there, you can email us. This show is falling off the track. Speechscience2018@gmail.com or give us a phone call, 614-681-1798. We'll be right back. You're listening to Speech Science.
Hey, everyone. You know, let's all stop what we're doing right now and take a moment. That felt good, huh? Just like that, we had a nice special sort of moment together. Of course, they don't all need to be quiet moments to be special. They could be loud moments, goofy moments, sporty moments, dorky moments. Moments where we talk or walk or just hang out. It doesn't really matter. They all count. Because every time dads like us take a moment like that to spend with our kids, well, it's pretty momentous. Sounds like somebody agrees. So let's take a moment to make a moment. Today, call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
As humans, we ask ourselves all kinds of questions. But what if we were forced to ask ourselves a question every day that affected the outcome of the most basic things, the most important things in our lives? The question is, what is your sexual orientation or gender identity? And the answer is the difference between keeping your job or getting fired. The answer is the difference between staying in your home or getting evicted. The answer is the difference between receiving medical treatment or not. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against people based on their answer to this question. LGBT Americans have the right to say, I do, but they don't have the same basic rights as everyone else. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Speed Science. I'm Matt Hott, Michelle Wintering, Michael McLeod, and Lucas Stoiber. You're in the order from top to bottom, according to Zoom, which we record on. Let's wrap this puppy up and send it home. Michelle, what are you doing this week? Tell us something fun and or exciting, or both.
Fun and or exciting. All right, can you come back to me?
Okay, Michael McLeod.
Pretty much just working, just getting my research study started on Wednesday, so I'll be prepping for that.
Awesome. Luke?
I had a conference presentation coming up that is totally free online streaming at AAC in the Cloud, if you Google that. Oh, shit. Sorry, now I swore. Nope, not AAC in the Cloud. I have a free conference presentation coming up at AAC After Work. AAC After Work is coming up next week, and that'll be neat. And other than that, I'm mostly going to be hiding under my bed whimpering until then.
Aww.
I didn't update you guys that we're actually in our house and our household goods were delivered. So we have our stuff now. So unpacking, and my little nieces are coming to visit this weekend. So that's exciting.
Awesome. For me, I am just doing more more of the same, just kind of home carrying it up. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. I'm working the Cincinnati Comic Con Expo this weekend. So if you're in the Cincinnati area, come on down and say hi to me. I'm in the admissions area selling tickets and running the.
Are you going to dress up?
No, I don't. I'm not a big cosplayer guy, but we do have Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones come into the show. So
I feel like if you drew some lines on your chin, you could pull off a Thanos.
I could see that.
Dude, okay, funny story to end the show on. We rented Infinity War so my son, my oldest, could watch it. He fell asleep with about 25 minutes left into the movie. So me being the good dad, I replayed it so that we could watch it. And the darn thing, the movie rental expired in the middle of the show.
So everybody's dead, huh?
So no, I had to like re-rent it for the second time just so he could watch the last hour of the show. That's how my day's going.
It was worth it. Great movie.
It was. I loved it. He loved it. All right. So let's send this thing home. Oh, sorry, Luke.
I was going to say that was one of the movies that was playing when I was just flying back from Sweden, which is like a 10-hour flight, right? So like I could look over the seats and ahead of me and watch all these different people at different stages of watching Infinity War. And I kept wanting to walk up behind them and just whisper like, they're all dead.
I don't feel so good, Mr. Stark.
Exactly.
Our opening music is Please Listen Carefully by Jazar. It's licensed under an attribution and share alike license. Our bump music is The Temperature of the Air on the Bow of the Calateen by Chris Zabriski, which is also licensed under an attribution and share alike license. And our closing music tonight is The Slow Burn by Kevin MacLeod, also licensed under an attribution and share alike license. In the immortal words of Janice Wright, be a willow because the willow bends over in the storm but doesn't break. The strong oak will break and cannot be repaired. For Michelle Wendering, Michael MacLeod, and Lucas Stoiber, I'm Matt Hott saying, till next week, peace, love, and I'm out.